really to talk about hospice eligibility, payer eligibility, specifically around Medicare, although we will talk about some other coverage because of the secondary Medicare component, to talk about the VBID expansion and how VBID is impacting hospices who are not necessarily in those participating areas, and to understand the impact of the Medicare data breach, which I've spoken to several people in hospice lately that weren't aware of that breach. So we wanted to bring that to light because we're seeing some changes there that are impacting claims and payments. So again, some of these slides I will go through faster because they're not really about change. They're just information that I wanted to review. And we talk about confirming insurance coverage, right? Because everything that a patient has coverage with any payer or policy or plan is important in the hospice realm, even if a patient is Medicare Part A. It's important just to know what all coverage they have. So we best practices talk about getting all of those policies and plans upon admission or referral when a hospice patient comes into your service. For Medicare patients specifically, of course, you want to confirm their MBI, make sure you have the spelling of the first and last name accurate and the date of birth and a social security number if the MBI is unknown. However, again, best practice that we recommend is that you always obtain a social security number. So in the event of an MBI change or an MBI issue where you're unable to pull eligibility, you can use that information to go into your Medicare e-services online and use your MBI lookup tool. So social security number, although it is a piece of protected data that Medicare really pushes their patients not to share, it can become crucial in you obtaining the correct MBI and also in getting paid. So there are lots of platforms and portals to pull Medicare eligibility, and this is just a list of the most common, I think. You can use, you know, one that you may pay for, eSolutions, Ability Ease, or you may be using your online provider services directly through your Mac. Of course, you can always use the automated phone system, which is a lot more cumbersome, but it works. And then there are integrated portals within several EMRs that are also available. Way back, it's been since 2016 when Medicare split and pulled what they now call HITS, which is not directly giving us access to HIQH or HIQA anymore. It created a little bit of a challenge because many patients had hospice prior to 2016, and they only went back 4 years in pulling that history. So we're still seeing some of the ramifications of that for some hospice patients, because where you might pull an eligibility and appears the patient has no prior Medicare hospice elections, truly there may have been, but they're just so old that they're not pulled into the new HET system. And then some systems, depending on where you're pulling eligibility, might produce different results. And this is just an example of an eligibility that we ran in two different places because we ran into an issue with prior hospice benefits not showing on the eligibility. So I'll point out first that if you pull an eligibility that looks like this and you're seeing only one hospice benefit, the first clue for me would be that this is a 60-day period effective in termination, and no revocation posted. So it's 60 days, not 90. So that would kind of be a clue, but that's probably not something that you would notice on first glance. However, this same patient, we pulled eligibility in a different system and it produced these results. So as you can see, the patient had many hospice benefit periods in a hospice election prior, and you know the implications of that had you admitted this patient assuming they had one 90-day period prior and were in their second 90, when in fact they were in their 12th 60-day period or 12th period overall, then you were probably missing face-to-face documentation, you know, CTI information. It really just throws everything off. So super important that you are aware of how much data is being pulled when you're checking eligibility, and looking for clues that you may not have at all. And then this, just a link to reading the eligibility reports, which I think we're all familiar with, and there are some additional slides in eligibility that are in this presentation as well. This is important because we want to make sure that as you're checking eligibility, you're looking at that termination date, and I highlighted it so we can show that, you know, this patient has Part A effective 2015 with no termination. And the reason we're pointing this out and highlighting it is because we will talk about the MBI data breach and how that might be impacting eligibilities and what you're seeing, even on patients that are current with you. If you rerun an eligibility, you might find that the MBI you're currently using for billing is terminated or end dated. So we'll talk about the data breach further in the presentation, but I just want to make sure everybody's aware of why I'm sharing the screen and what information is important. Same information here, and we use this as just another example of what you're looking for in eligibility. And then, of course, to be eligible for hospice, a patient must have Part A, Medicare Part A, with no termination date. Any prior hospice elections must be closed unless it's a transfer. If a prior hospice has an open election and the patient is not a transfer, you still must enter your notice of election within 5 days, even though it will RTP, in order for your claim to qualify as an exception. And if the patient is an incoming transfer, confirm that there's only one transfer in the current benefit period. And then even if the patient is Medicare secondary, you want to make sure that you're meeting all of the Medicare guidelines so that you're able to bill any balances to Medicare after the primary payer pays. And again, we just talked about all of the prior hospice elections and the items that you want to make sure you're confirming upon admission with your patient. So if they have a prior hospice election that's open, you know, if they haven't completed billing, you're contacting them, confirming your discharge date so that you're sure you're not overlapping, which will help you to avoid a dispute. And you want to make sure that you're in the right benefit period. In Medicare secondary, this is one of the more complex claims that we find sometimes if a patient has both a primary commercial insurance through their employer or their spouse's employer, and they also have Medicare, that sometimes the Medicare information is not obtained, and therefore the Medicare secondary claims are not submitted, so there's no Medicare notice of election, there's no claims, and it's really important that we bill to all payers, even if a primary payer is paying the claim in full. Those claims should still go to Medicare with all of the correct documentation and coding to show that Medicare does not owe a balance. But it's important because if that primary payer is terminated and Medicare becomes primary, then all the subsequent claims going to Medicare will be in the right order. All your prior claims have been processed and the claims will start paying by Medicare. Just again, another slide for informational purposes to show the types of MSP policies you might see in a Medicare eligibility. And the one that we interact with the most is working age. So those are your commercial plans through an employer or a spouse's employer that a patient may have coverage with as primary. And then if you're unsure of which payer is primary, there are tools that CMS gives us. And I just gave you the links for those in case you all don't have them. And the guidelines for billing Medicare secondary claims. So the hospice value-based insurance design, which is our VBID pilot, is in full swing. Everybody knows since 2020. And for hospices that are not in those geographic areas, and maybe you all aren't impacted and maybe don't know a lot about it because it's not something you're dealing with within your hospice. But the way the pilot is designed, the participating plans cover a geographical area. So for those of you not in those counties or states where there are participating plans, that pilot may not be on your radar at all. But what we're seeing more and more of are patients who have elected a plan that is participating in this pilot, which is a Medicare Advantage plan that the hospice is required to bill both to Medicare and to the plan, and you have to follow the notice of election, has to be submitted timely within 5 days to both Medicare and the plan, and then you bill both and the plan pays, right? So when VBID is not really on your radar because you're not in those areas, we're seeing a lot more patients moving around the country, and they have one of these participating plans, and if they, elect hospice with your agency, you may pull up their eligibility and not think to even reference the VBID plan sheet to confirm whether or not the plan they have in place is one that is participating and needs to be billed. So that's really the highlight of this for us, is that we are seeing a lot of patients moving around and hospices not realizing until they submit their first claim to Medicare and have it denied, they're not realizing that the Medicare Advantage plan on the eligibility is actually a participating plan. And we have questioned the CMS VBID group about the moving of a patient if they leave the geographical area. Should they terminate that plan, or are they still covered under that plan? And they confirmed with us that patients are covered under their plan regardless of where they live. If they've chosen that plan, then they can continue to be covered under it. So best practice, again, is to make sure that when you're pulling eligibility on a referral, and if there's anything in that Medicare Advantage plan page, that you are cross-referencing that plan number with the extension to the plan list of participating VBID Medicare Advantage plans. Now, this is a little more confusing, and we've had different information given to us through different MACs and also through, again, the Medicare Advantage pilot program that we email directly. So for patients, this is how it's supposed to work. For patients who elect hospice with traditional Medicare in years prior to a plan's participation, the patient remains covered under Part A, even if they have chosen a VBID plan or choose one at a later date. Well, what we're finding, though, is now that we have been in the pilot for several years, there are plans that may have participated in a prior year, and then they opt out for a year, and then they return into the pilot in the subsequent year. And I'll just give an example. If a patient elected hospice in July of 2023, and they have a Medicare Advantage plan that participated in the VBID pilot in 2022, opted out in 2023, and is participating again in 2024, what the VBID organization will tell us is that patient will remain covered under Medicare Part A because they elected hospice with Medicare Part A when the plan was not participating. What we're finding, though, is sometimes we bill those patients, continue to bill them to Medicare, and the plan goes into effect on January 1 of 2024, and Medicare claims start to deny us covered under a VBID plan. So it's really confusing. It doesn't appear to work as they have it outlined. And even though we've questioned and sent specific examples, they always respond with the same answer that the patient is covered under Medicare Part A. But we're seeing something different in the actual billing and claim denials from Medicare, and then the plan saying, yes, that patient is covered under the Medicare Advantage plan. So no great advice there for how to resolve that, since we're getting conflicting information. And we even spoke with representatives from CGS specifically, who acknowledge that they're also seeing some of those discrepancies. But we would say that if you have a patient that has a plan that is participating next year, maybe not participating this year, that you reach out to that plan and determine if you need to submit a notice of election. And truly, I don't think it's harmful to submit one. If they're not going to pay you, no harm, no foul, right? But if you actually need to submit one and you haven't, then you may run into issues with payment when you start billing in 2024. And we always recommend a best practice of monthly insurance verifications for all payers. And that way you can monitor those Medicare Advantage plan pages and determine if, you know, you feel like there's something changing with the patient that needs more attention and maybe some research into the Medicare Advantage plan they've chosen. And this is the VBID plan information link to get all of the documentation that I'm talking about. There's an email there for info if you have questions directly to those administering this pilot. There's also the spreadsheet that updates every year that has all of the plans listed for all, by state and then by county, so it's really easy to cross-reference. And the new topic, and this is where this ties back to my first segment about Medicare eligibility, right? So not sure that everyone is aware that Medicare had a data breach of over 600,000 MBIs. So the response to that breach is Medicare will issue new MBIs to those patients who were compromised. And as you can imagine, that would, and we're starting to see some of those changes within our hospice population. So it's important, again, that we're verifying eligibility, not just on new admits, but on your current hospice census. So what does a new MBI mean for providers? The patients already on service may have an NOE and claims that are already submitted and paid by Medicare, but their MBI was part of this breach. So Medicare end dates the old MBI, sends the patient a new MBI, and they're supposed to make those two numbers talk within their system. So what should happen is you start billing with the new MBI, and it should claims should process as they were processing before. It should fall right in line sequentially with your last claim. There should be no disruption in payment. However, the tie-in doesn't always work on the Medicare side, and sometimes the two MBIs become disassociated. And when that happens, you'll submit that first claim with that new MBI number, and it will deny with a reason code that says there's no claim with dates of service ending one day prior to your new claim, right? We've all seen that. So immediate action would be to contact your Medicare administrative contractor, point out the issue, and request that they reassociate those two numbers. And we found that sometimes that process takes longer than they say it will. So it's really important that we're monitoring those, that we're calling frequently, keeping all of your notes with your call reference numbers, and making certain that you're following up, because sometimes, of course, we know if we don't, then it never gets resolved and you could stack up months of dollars and claims unpaid. So really important that we stay on top of that. And again, it gets layered and complicated on the Medicare end, because if you remember prior to MBIs, the Medicare number was the recipient's Social Security number with a letter, right? If they were the primary beneficiary, they had an A. If they were on their spouse's benefits, they had a B. If their spouse was deceased, it would change to a D. And we see some of those disassociations happening even without the breach, because if a patient had their spouse's Medicare benefits prior to being issued an MBI, initially they had the spouse's social with a B, let's say, and then the spouse passes away. Well, that initial Medicare number is still embedded in the Medicare system, and it's associated with the MBI that we're provided when a patient elects hospice. But if that initial Medicare number changes, spouse passes away, and now the MBI for the person who's not the primary beneficiary changes from a B to a D, that will trigger a disassociation between the old Medicare number and the patient's MBI. Now some of these patients are getting new MBIs. So you can see how the layered Medicare number issue can become very convoluted and complicated, and how there's multiple parts in that process that could allow, you know, something to be disassociated and no longer talking and not linked to the patient. So very important that we're monitoring the eligibilities, that we're looking for end dates on your eligibilities, and seeking out that new MBI from the family or the patient, and if not, using that Social Security number to get into your MBI lookup tool to get that information. This is everything I just covered, and we want to make certain that for new referrals, again, you might be provided with an MBI that is end dated when you pull eligibility. And we want to be looking for that. I know a lot of us look at eligibilities all day long, a lot of those documents. And so sometimes these particular data points can be missed. It's not something we see very often, and it is easy to miss. So just be certain that you're looking at the end date and the response file from the report to be certain you have the most current MBI. And if you don't and you file that MOE, it will come back. And then if it's untimely, past your 5 days, Medicare says that's a provider error. It's up to us to obtain the correct MBI and patient payer information. So we want to be certain we're getting it up front. And if we don't have it, then using our tools to obtain it. This is really not a change. This is just information, again, that I wanted to include, because when we're talking about payers and eligibility and all of those pieces and parts for different types of payers. We just wanted to keep it one good resource document. So I just included information about other payers, commercial, Medicare, VA, and just being certain. And it does tie back to Medicare secondary, right? So if you have a commercial payer that is primary over Medicare, it's important that we're following all of that payer's guidelines. We're obtaining authorizations, we're billing correctly and timely, so that when we get those either payment, partial payment, whatever that remittance is, we are able to turn around and bill Medicare. So all of your payers interconnect in that sense. When you have an MSP, you want to make certain you're following your primary payer's guidelines as well as Medicare's guidelines. And just a note about VA, VA CCN versus Medicare, you know, one is not primary over the other. The patient decides which benefit to use, and usually your VA referral comes from your local VA, so you would know that is a VA benefit, just to be certain that we're clear about the fact that they're not both, one's not primary and secondary. And then again, just the data, you want to make certain that you're obtaining upon referral, that you're getting the patient's plan and policy information, that you have an authorization phone number or access to the payer portal, that you know if it's a brand new payer to you, do you have the electronic payer ID or the mailing address, and making certain that the patient is the policy subscriber, and if not, you're obtaining the information for that policyholder. And this is just information, again, about obtaining authorizations, making sure you're asking for auth on the correct codes that you're contracted with, or that the payer actually pays, and that's all information usually obtained in your contract. If you're not contracted, there should be a list of what type of benefits and coverage the patient has specific to that plan if they're out of network, and all of the things that you want to know about a payer and a policy prior to taking a patient, or just to make certain that you have the information needed to get paid. And that is the full presentation. Again, I just want to make sure that we covered the points of change, and that was really the point of the presentation, to talk about the payer changes and the Medicare eligibility and how it relates both to the VBID pilot, how it relates to the MBI data breach, and making certain that you all have best practice in place and checking eligibility at least monthly on your patients. And we recommend that for payers across the board, because things can change retroactively, and you want to be certain that, you know, you're filing your MSP claims again, even if you aren't expecting payment from Medicare because the policy terminates, you have no other changes other than to keep submitting those claims as primary to Medicare, and to understand the data breach and the layers of complexity with patients who have had Medicare since their old Medicare number to the new MBI, and now maybe to a new MBI on top of that one. So just to be clear that we've covered those changes, and if anyone has any questions, if you want to drop them in the Q&A, we can take a look at those. Matt, I'm not sure if you see anything. I don't see any questions in the Q&A or in the chat box.
I don't see any questions in the chat box. You can also raise your hand if you have any questions you want to voice, and we can unmute you.
Karen? Was it Karen who raised her hand? I'm sorry.
Maria, I think.
I don't
think you have to do it, Elaine.
Yep, I can. Hi, Maria. I think you're muted on your end.
Okay, I unmuted it now. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
Thanks. Thanks so much for this valuable information. So from the topic, we're talking about changes in 2024, right? What is advanced revenue cycle able to do in this process? What is it that you're bringing to the table for us to know that we don't want to miss? I didn't have any questions about eligibility. I didn't have any questions about the insurances. Of course, I would need help with Medicare Advantage plans if I go with them. What is it that we could look forward to from advanced revenue cycle in this process? How can we get more improved in our services with yours?
So just to be sure I understand, are you asking what services we offer as a company that could help you identify and manage your Medicare Advantage patients?
Yes. From the topic, what I see is that there are challenges that are coming up, right?
Yes.
And in case...
So we...
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, you know, how we serve our clients currently, we, of course, do billing and revenue cycle management, but we have additional services for eligibility, authorizations, and we can help you either facilitate a better process internally or do those pieces for you. So that's just another part of our service line.
Okay. And you do this only for hospice or home health as well?
We do home health as well. We do hospice, home health, and palliative care, which we know a lot of our hospices also serve a palliative population.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you so much for that.
You're welcome. I don't see any additional questions. And of course, if anybody thinks of something after the call, you're certainly welcome to reach out to us on email. We're happy to answer any questions, set up a time to talk if you feel like you need more information on any of the topics we've covered. And of course, please share the slide presentation and the recording with anyone within your group who might benefit from this information as well. We do have a few more minutes, but I don't see anything coming across. Matt, did you have anything additional to add?
No, just a reminder, the next webinar in this series is on December 12th, and there'll be follow-up information to make sure you can register and attend. So thank you all for coming. We'll share this recording out on the other side, like Lane mentioned, and have a great rest of your day.
Thank you all. We appreciate you.